You're tuned to 1520 WCHE Radio, and it's time now for the Avid Reader Show with your host, Sam Hankin. Sam will offer reviews and interviews of some of the more interesting books and authors of today, and now Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, and welcome to another edition of the Avid Reader, brought to you by the Wellington Square Bookshop, my bookshop. Today we're lucky to have with us James McBride, author of The Good Lord Bird.
National Book Award winner for 2013, published by Riverhead Books, an imprint of Penguin. Now in paperback and sitting on the front table of my bookstore. The Good Lord Bird is, as Baz Dresinger, the reviewer for The Times, says, a brilliant romp of a novel about John Brown, narrated by a freed slave boy who passes as a girl. It's a comedy of race, kind of, a comedy that by comedy's very nature gives us a lot more insight into things than a simple history or recitation of facts or even a serious novel can give you. The comedy of the book is what allows us to laugh, to step back, to ponder, to evaluate, to reevaluate, and then to thank the author for telling us, hey, this is how things really might have been or really were. You understand now? It's a soft sell, but when properly wrought is a surefire way to get a message across, and James is an expert at it. James is also an accomplished musician. In fact, his next book is a biography of James Brown. Not John Brown, James Brown. He wrote what is now considered by most an American classic about his family and his mom, and his 11 siblings, The Color of Water. I was honored to be at a dinner and book signing with James the other night, and I kept hearing people coming up to him saying all these wonderful things about the book, like how it's changed their life. James did write The Color of Water and The Miracle of St. Anna, which was made into a film by Spike Lee. You may have missed it, but it was a great movie. James has written for The Washington Post, Rolling Stone, and The New York Times, among others. He graduated from Oberlin and holds a master's from Columbia. He's the writer in residence at NYU. He loves Philadelphia, has a lot of roots here, and still lives here part-time, just about an hour or so away from where I'm sitting now. So as usual, I've blabbed on a little, so I'll just say, hi, James. Thanks for taking the time to chat with us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Before I get carried away with myself, and I know you have a ton of work today, why don't we try to sell some books? Why don't you tell us a little bit about The Good Lord Bird?
Well, essentially, The Good Lord Bird is about John Brown, who's an abolitionist who decided to end slavery by himself. And he did that by, he decided to attack Harper's Ferry, which at the time was America's biggest arsenal. And he almost got away with it, actually. He would have gotten away with it. He held the place for 3 days, but after about a day and a half, when he could have escaped, he didn't escape. He just waited for the black people to come, and they never came. He thought blacks would hear about his revolt and flock to his side and, you know, join his great revolt against slavery, but that didn't happen. So he was caught and eventually hung, him and several others.
Well, you know, a lot of the books about timing and ill timing and... You know, along with that, it's interesting when I read the book, you know, I have this idea of who Frederick Douglass was from school and what a great man he was and what a great champion he was for freedom for black people. But in your book, you kind of make him kind of he's a mixed blessing, isn't he?
Well, I mean, you know, I've been criticized for the portrayal of Frederick Douglass in the book because he comes off as a kind of horny dude, you know.
Yeah, horny horny towards the wrong person too.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, he's just it's like most men, I guess. But I mean, he was just you know, Frederick Douglass was a great leader, but he was a politician, and you know, he was a flawed person, and. You know, he doesn't acquit himself very well in this particular situation, because the young lady that he's trying to bed down is actually a boy disguised as a girl, and that's the person who's telling the whole book, who's giving us the narrator of the book is actually a 10-year-old boy who John Brown mistakes for a girl, and the boy is so scared that. Tell this white guy that the truth, he just pretends to be a girl throughout the book. So, I mean, listen, in real life, Frederick Douglass had a, you know, he had a black wife and a white mistress, and at one point they lived in the same house, and that's weird. I mean, it was weird in the 1800s, and it's weird. It would be weird now. So, and in a book of satire, that's just this, you know, in a book of caricature, you just can't leave that one alone. So, you know, but you know, in my defense, I make fun of everyone in The Good Lord Bird.
Yeah, you do.
I poke fun at everybody.
And that's kind of what I was saying at the outset. I think that gives you, that allows a reader to get a little perspective, rather than a dry historical. And then, you know, you create a protagonist that didn't exist in real life, but the protagonist is a very, very complex person too. And I wonder why, and the person, that an onion has a lot of qualities in there. When you talk about a lot about his actions and then some situations, his inactions, and you decided to go there, and it creates a big deal in the book. So what do you think about Onion? In retrospect, and after, you know, finding the manuscript in the church and all that, what do you think about Onion in terms of whether he was a good guy or a bad guy?
Well, I mean, just to catch the listener, Onion is the little boy's name. Onion is all of us in many ways. You know, we all simply, you know, we all don't say things when they should be said, and we all kind of are quiet on elements that we should probably speak out on. And Onion was, in many ways, a metaphor for all of us. I mean, during slavery, a lot of people didn't agree with it, and they found it to be, I mean, most white people didn't own slaves. The truth of the matter is that only really rich people own slaves. And today, only really rich people can afford to, you know, pay $1 million for, you know, an 800 square foot apartment on 43rd Street in Manhattan. I mean, I don't even know who these people are. They have so much money. So, I mean, it's just, no one's saying a whole bunch about that. It's just, you know, we float in these different worlds, and we sometimes can't step back from them far enough to see that some of this stuff just doesn't really make sense.
And
that's one reason why Onion is so important as a character.
You know, you think back to when slaves were sold or bought for $1,200 or $1,300. That was like a fortune back then.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's why John Brown was reviled and hated by slave owners. I mean, this is a guy who would, look, if I go to your house and steal your car because I'm against global warming, you know, you don't care. I mean, yeah, well, you know, you're gonna want the cops to come and arrest me. And in those days, blacks were not seen as people, but rather as property. You know, property that many people loved and admired, and some hated, and some used and abused, but property nonetheless. And you couldn't just walk onto someone's farm or plantation and tell his or her black people that they were free. You know, that would get you put in jail or worse. And well, John Brown did that quite a bit.
Yeah, it's interesting because, I don't know, it's like you were saying about property and the very few people, prospectively, who own slaves. But, you know, and what you say about John Brown is very true, is that he affected change in terms of people's attitudes towards slavery in a lot better way after the tragedy at Harper's Ferry, didn't he?
Ironically, the answer is yes. I mean, ironically, John Brown felt that violence, at the end, that violence would be the only thing that America paid any attention to. But the fact is that after he was captured during his raid on Harper's Ferry, he was put in prison for 6 weeks before he was hung. And it was during that 6 weeks when he began to write letters to the newspaper and letters to his friends. It was then, only then, did he really... did his message come across, and come across big. And he did more with a pen in 6 weeks than he did with a gun and a sword for the previous 2.5 years, when he was fighting slavery with you know, with guns and you know, skirmishes and wars and so forth. So it is ironic that at the end of his life, that he did more with his pen than he did with a broadsword, and I still think that's the case.
Yeah, there's so many
people. You can do a lot of stuff with a pen.
You know, it's funny, in Baz's review, she talks about passing, and she talks about that cultural, I guess, not back then before they had memes, but that cultural idea of trying to get by either as a white person or as a light-skinned black. And then you have Onion, who is getting by pretending that he's a girl. What's your take on what she's talking about in terms of passing? Because I know she's written about it, too.
Well, it's a little bit different now than it was, you know. I mean, it's a lot different now than it was, you know, in 1859. I mean, nowadays, you know, passing is an economic element. I mean, if you have money in America now, you can pretty much, you know, do what you want, you know.
Yeah, look at the Kardashians.
They say things about you, but, pardon me?
I was going to say, look at Kim Kardashian and Kanye. I mean, they can do
it. Yeah, well, I mean, yeah. I mean, they're not the model couple that I'd want my kids to come, you know, end up being like, that's for sure.
Me neither.
I mean, you know. I mean, it basically, it's, you know, if you want to be a kind of a, you know, a Hollywood phony baloney, it doesn't matter what color you are. If you have the money and the desire, you know, go right ahead. But if you want to live a life of purpose and growth and, you know, learning and true labor, then, you know, that's something that's open to anyone as long as you have an education and you were raised right. But in the 1850s, you know, it would passing meant you just try your best to look like a white person, and it would probably help you some. And there are some people who pass now, you know, who are like black, but really act like Condoleezza Rice is passing. You know, she's not like, she hasn't done anything for black people or poor people that I can recall. I mean, you know, I'm no fan of hers.
I don't know, it's kind of like the Cosby kid mentality. You know, when the Cosby Show was on, it was the same kind of thing.
Those people. There's nothing wrong with being middle class. I think the real issue is, what are you doing to help the world? I didn't sit down to write The Good Lord Bird because I wanted people to, I don't know, to think that passing was a good thing. I wanted people to see that we all have a responsibility towards each other, whether we like it or not. And you can't blame anyone for slavery. You just say, well, that's how it was because we inherited that. And since we inherited that, let's flip our inheritance around a little bit and get something positive from it. And yeah. Smile at it and enjoy the parts of it that can be enjoyed and understand the parts of it that give us pain, that we can move forward and be more together as a country.
Yeah, it's like when you were giving your acceptance speech when you won the Book of the Year Award, and you were talking about E.L. Doctorow. Now, when you first heard him, you thought, you know, I should really be doing something about this. And then you felt bad that you hadn't. And now you have, right? I mean, in a lot of ways.
Well, that's, yeah, yeah, that's funny you should mention. Yeah, that's true. E.L. Doctorow gave a commencement address shortly after the Iraq War started at a school on Long Island at a college. And they booed him, you know. And I just was, I couldn't believe it, you know, when I heard that. I just thought that was horrible. But I didn't say anything. I didn't do anything about it, you know. And I probably should have, you know, done something, but I didn't. So in some ways, yes, this book is my response to that moment. You know, trying to illuminate a little bit for people that would help them understand why we have such difficulty talking to each other sometimes.
It's funny, when you were giving your talk at the Free Library downtown, which it sounds like you hung out a lot, and my brother and I used to go down there every Saturday and spend all day there. It's a wonderful place. But you talked about your mom living at 4917 Green Street, and I lived at 6484 Ardley Street, and I looked at Google Maps last night, and my house and hers were like a mile apart, and we used to drive by her house because my mom wanted to go to this house where this lady made the best rotisserie chicken in the world. So we'd go by there every week, and that really struck me as funny. you know, because I lived there.
Wow, that's interesting. Well, Germantown, yeah. You know, Germantown has really, lower Germantown has not changed. In fact, it's gotten a little worse.
Yeah, it's, you know, they all got this, all those houses that have that Philadelphia, I guess they even call it Philadelphia stone. We lived in a row house, you know, and it was like, it was a very interesting place to grow up, but it was a lot of fun, too. I mean, Germantown is a very interesting place, and then along the Wissahickon Creek and all that, we had a good time growing up there.
Oh, yeah, I mean, I have a sister who lives in Germantown. I still have two sisters who live in.
Really?
One lives downtown, one lives in Germantown, and I mean, I'm there all the time, you know, at my sister's house, and I still think Germantown's cool. I just wish that they've been saying Germantown's going to come back for the last 30 years, and I'm waiting for. I mean, it may well, because now there's certain sections of it, particularly near Wayne Junction, that have deteriorated in ways that I just thought I'd never see, and that's usually. Oftentimes, that's a sign that it's about to really bounce back. I'm hoping that's the case. But development is creeping down that way from Mount Airy, and it's coming, but it's slow. Philly's a great city, and Germantown's a great neighborhood, and we had many good years there.
Yes, it's a like a tight rope to walk, because like when you were talking about living in Hell's Kitchen, Hell's Kitchen was once Hell's Kitchen, just like Times Square. But now, as you said in that talk, I don't remember where it was, that is kind of, you know, Disney-fied. So it's like a tough row to hoe, you know? It's like you don't want it to turn into some kind of theme park, but at the same time, you want it to change, you know?
Well, I mean, I think that if they Disney-fied Germantown, it wouldn't hurt Germantown. I mean, that Germantown is never going to change that much.
No.
They can Disney-fy Hell's Kitchen because Times Square is, you know, three blocks away from where I am at 43rd and 10th, but they're not gonna. You ain't gonna see tourists from Iowa coming to Germantown by by the thousands to see, you know, George Washington slept here. That just ain't gonna happen.
But always
Philadelphia is just too. Philadelphia is too interesting to be totally Disney-fied. It's got too much real history in it.
What always gets me is people who come from wherever they come from, Iowa, California, Germany, and. When they stay in Times Square, and then I see them all lined up outside of Fridays. You know, it's like, you came to New York, and you're going to the same place that's on every street in your strip mall, you know?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you know, why even come?
Yeah.
You know?
To go to the Disney store or Toys R Us. It's silly.
Yeah, I mean, well, you know, look, this is why I write books, because people live in their own box. And your job as a writer is to sort of open... One of your jobs, anyway, is to sort of open the world to them so they see parts of the world that they might not normally experience. I mean, if you grew up in the Germantown area, you have a certain understanding of African Americans and the complexity of African American life that many people don't have. Actually, I think Philadelphians are pretty sophisticated about some of these things because Philadelphia's, even though Philadelphia is segregated, it's more integrated than most cities. And a lot of white people in Philadelphia, particularly those who live in the city, are very, very sophisticated about black life, partly because they live amongst blacks and, you know, have a lot of dealings with black friends and black associates and black, you know, colleagues at work. But I don't know that all of them are. I'm not sure that a lot of this country has that same experience.
Well, I can tell with the next generation of kids, because like my nephews and my children, when they went to school, it just wasn't, it was transparent like a color of water. They never differentiated between anybody. All their friends were just their friends. The most they might do is if I said, well, who's this kid? They go, you know, he's the dark-skinned one. But they wouldn't say it. They would just use it as an identification. They never made any differentiation in terms of a hierarchical kind of situation. And that always made me happy. It gave me hope for the future.
Well, I think the younger generation, they seem to be, you know, a lot hipper about elements of race in some ways than we were. But I think the big one is class, really. And the loss of sort of a cultural index that existed when we were children. you know, and television and its impact on how people think. There's nothing more depressing than seeing a young person walking down the street with iPads, you know, some kind of earplug on, and just completely unplugged in, you know, tuned out to what's happening around them. That's just, you want to be a writer, you ought to just, you need to stick those earbuds in your pocket and you know, stagger over to the library and spend a couple hours there every week.
Yeah, and even just, well, taking the earplugs out and listening to people talk, just listening to the cadence and the voice, and, you know, you end up getting part of your dialogue from what you hear on the street or in the subway. And, you know, a lot often...
Well, that's my job, you know.
Right.
My job is to hear people, so whether it doesn't matter whether it's, picking up dialogue that exists in 1859 or dialogue that exists now, I have to hear people and see how they interact, you know.
Well, there was two things that I remember. One, the guy who's kind of like your research buddy at the library, who you were always calling upon, you know, he shows the aspect of your writing that's based on intensive research. And then the guy who, I've forgotten his name, the gentleman who introduced you at the National Book Awards, who used to be the assistant editor at New Yorker, what's his name?
I've forgotten his name, but I know who you're talking about.
Yeah, so when he introduced you, what he said, and which is true, is of, oh, it's funny, because I interviewed Rachel Kushner about Flamethrowers, and I interviewed George Saunders about the 10th of December, and what you said in your acceptance speech was, you know, all the, you were happy you won, but all those books were, you know, great books, and they were. And the key about all those books is what that guy said when he introduced you, which is you find at one point in your book very early on that you've embedded yourself in the book itself, and you're in a different world. And I think that's the best thing a writer can do. So,
you know. Yeah, that's true. And the writers that you mentioned are great writers. And I wouldn't have been disappointed if either of their books had been awarded the National Book Award. I mean, that was a difficult moment for me.
I could tell.
And I never planned to go through that again. You know.
Well, what was cool
sitting
about
there
it was
waiting.
You didn't have you didn't have a speech. And, you know, you just wrote those notes down, but what you said about E.L. Doctor I thought was very poignant, and, you know, it's very true. I mean, your books, including The Color of Water, really, especially The Color of Water, allow you, even though it's a memoir and not a novel, allows you to step into somebody else's world. And it's really hard to do that right, and that's why everyone's going, it's an American classic, or Change My Life, or whatever. Well, James, I know you're busy, and I appreciate the time you've taken to join us today. So best of luck to you, and I know you're writing a book about James Brown, and I look forward to maybe you coming back and talking to us again.
Sure, it was great seeing you both outside the studio and in the studio as well, so I hope to see you again as well.
Okay, great. Talk to you soon.
All right, take care.
You too. I want to thank James McBride for talking to us today. He's really been busy, and he's going to Copenhagen today to talk about it. Although I don't know how they could translate a book about American slavery in the 1800s into Danish. But I'm sure they did a good job. In any event, next week we'll be talking to Christina Enriquez, who wrote The Book of Unknown Americans. It's an immigration story. There's a lot of books about immigration now, but it's different in the sense that it's a diaspora of Latin Americans who come to America. Actually, they settle in Delaware, not too far from our own Kennett Square, and a lot of them go to work picking mushrooms. But in any event, it's the idea of the American dream and what's come of it. Can anybody still achieve it in this world? And it's a fascinating look at the lives of people who all live in the same apartment complex, but all have different stories about their journey to, and in some cases, their journey back to the place of their origination. So join us next week when we talk to Christina Enriquez, her book, The Book of Unknown Americans. Thanks as always.
You've been listening to the Avid Reader Show with your host, Sam Hankin. Sam will be back next week with reviews and interviews of some of the more interesting books and authors of today.